was Treasury Secretary under Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. He also founded the National Gallery of Art. Biographer David Cannadine explores the history of the financial pioneer in his book, Mellon, An American Life. Mr. Cannadine spoke last month at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. for about an hour.
This evening, it is a singular pleasure to welcome to AEI David Cannadine. He is a professor at the University of London. In fact, I have to say this, Americans love to say these kinds of things. He is the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother Professor of British History at the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London. And he is also a chairman of the trustees of Britain's National Portrait Gallery, an institution with more than a passing relationship to the subject of his lecture this evening. Professor Cannadine received his PhD from Oxford. He has taught at Cambridge and at Princeton in the United States over the years. He is the author or editor of a dozen books, including The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy, published in the mid-1990s, and a recipient of the Lionel Trilling Prize and the Governor's Award. Most recently, Ornamentalism, How the British Saw Their Empire, and 4 years ago, In Churchill's Shadow, Confronting the Past in Modern Britain. His new book is Andrew W. Mellon, An Extraordinary Life, just published by Knopf in the United States. It will come out at the end of November by Penguin in the UK. And it is very much in the news and reviews in the United States of late. This is an extraordinary biography of an extraordinary but difficult to capture life. It began in a commission to the author himself from Andrew Mellon's son Paul before his death. The author had extraordinary access to the Mellon archives, and he has written, one can say it is the best biography of Mellon so far. In fact, I don't want to take any lines from him, but it is the first biography, full-length biography of Mellon so far. This extraordinarily accomplished, but also extraordinarily complex man. And we can say that this is not just the first, but will be the definitive biography due to its sources and to the fact that he has truly taken the measure of and breathed life into this very reticent man of such towering achievements. His title is the title of his is Andrew W. Mellon, An Extraordinary Life, based on the book. We're delighted that he is in the United States. He's just arrived. He will be lecturing on the book after his lecture here at AEI this evening. And we are delighted that he is beginning this tour at AEI. Please give a warm welcome to David Cannadine.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Chris, very much for those kind words. I was so enjoying what you were saying, I thought you could just have carried on, really, and I didn't have to say anything at all. I'm suitably both touched and crushed by your remark that this is the best life of Andrew Mellon yet written, but then again, it's the only life of Andrew Mellon yet written. But there we are. It's a huge pleasure to be here. I've already talked a bit about Andrew Mellon at the other end of town in the National Gallery. And, of course, the National Gallery is, in a sense, the other end of Andrew Mellon's life, the final amazing benefaction to the American people that he manages to pull off with barely 2 months to spare before he dies, an extraordinary story which I don't propose to tell you this evening because I've already told it at the gallery, and if you want to find out, you can read it in the book. But I suppose if you ask questions on that, I might give you a little taste of it. But it's the most amazing story, the process whereby Mellon creates the gallery. But of course, Mellon could not have created the gallery if he hadn't got lots of pictures, and he would not have had lots of pictures if he hadn't had a great deal of money to spend on the pictures. So that the key to understanding everything that comes charms of Mellon's life, in many ways, is the fact that he is brilliant at making money. Mellon was born in 1855. The Civil War had not yet started. He died in 1937. The Second World War was not that far off. And when he died, he was, roughly speaking, half the age of the United States itself, in whose history he had indeed played a very significant and, I think, hitherto insufficiently appreciated part. But, of course, one way of thinking about Mellon is to say that he was one member of a very extraordinary generation of extremely creative, successful, controversial businessmen. Businessmen: J.D. Rockefeller, Henry Clay Frick, Andrew Carnegie, Henry Ford, J.P. Morgan, William Randolph Hearst. They're all, give or take 10 years, pretty much contemporaries. And what they have in common is that they were both the creators and the beneficiaries of a process of economic transformation in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, whereby the American economy became the greatest wealth-generating machine that any nation has ever produced, a position which it still holds to this day. So that their activities and accomplishments are, to put it mildly, of more than just local significance. To many people in their lives, and to many writers about those lives since, these people were wholly and utterly reprehensible. They were called the robber barons. They were deemed to be people obsessed with profit. They were deemed to be people whose business methods were rather deplorable. They were deemed to be people who hated organized labor. They were deemed to be people who were, in many senses, completely irresponsible, crazed with making more money. But it's important to notice, and as I've got to know Mellon better, it's a view to which I have to say I have become more sympathetic, that their self-image wasn't like that at all. They saw themselves as great patriots, creative figures, as economic statesmen, as people whose labors built up the strength of the American economy, created jobs and work for lots of people who otherwise might not have work, or if they did, wouldn't be paid such good wages, and who, because the government couldn't do it for them, had to try to cope with things like the slump of 1907. So their image of themselves was very much different from the popular image of them as rapacious and irresponsible figures. And Mellon certainly had this sense of himself as, in some ways, a disinterested financier, a genuine American patriot who saw his main job as building up the strength of the country in such a way that everybody would benefit. Now, Mellon's life is remarkable for many reasons on its own terms, aside from the fact that he belongs to this generation with whom he shares many characteristics. But let me just stress two of them here. First, as has already been mentioned, there is no biography of Mellon, or at least there has been no published biography of Mellon before this one that I've just produced. And that marks him out from all of those contemporary figures whom I've already mentioned, many of whom have been biographed more than once. It is the case, when Mellon died in 1937, his son and daughter, Paul Mellon and Ailsa Mellon Bruce, did commission a writer called Burton Hendrick to write a life. They put him on a salary of $25,000 a year, a lot of money in those days, on condition that they would decide when he finished the book whether it should be published or not. And they decided it shouldn't be published. There's nothing in it that's discreditable to Mellon, but I think there was a sense that the world had moved on from the tax trial, the gallery had now been opened, and the thing was just put aside. And so, as a result of that, because a life had been written, Paul Mellon owned the papers, no other life was going to be written, and so nothing happened for the next 30 or 40 or 50 years. And it was only when Paul Mellon concluded that the Hendrick biography couldn't be revised, couldn't ever be published in any form, that he decided that a fresh start should be made, and he asked me to write the life of his father. But the consequence of this is that Mellon, who was a rather self-effacing and low-profile figure during his life, has been one of the absent figures from the history of America from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century, simply because there's been no biography. So while we all think we know something about Frick and Carnegie and Rockefeller, Mellon, by contrast, has had much less attention. So he was self-effacing in life and, in a sense, has been self-effacing ever since. Which means, put another way, that a big slice of American history that Mellon himself connects with has largely been ignored. The other way in which it seems to me Mellon is worth in particular stressing is that, unlike any of his contemporaries, he was preeminent in four different fields of human endeavor. He was a brilliant businessman, both as a banker, as a financier, as an industrialist, and that really is the key to everything. Until he was 65, that's what he spent most of his time doing. He was, of course, a major figure in politics, Secretary of the Treasury from 1921 to 1932, and Ambassador to London from 1932 to 1933. It was said of him that three presidents served under him while he was Secretary of the Treasury, a very dominant figure in Washington throughout that time. He was the greatest art collector of his generation, building up a quite astonishing collection, which I don't have time to talk about this afternoon either, but that is a remarkable strand of his story, especially the high point of it when he buys 21 pictures from the Hermitage between 1930 and 1931. At that point, he's Secretary of the Treasury. At that point, the American government doesn't recognize the communist government in Russia at all. It was, to put it mildly, a very audacious thing for him to be doing. And, of course, he was a remarkable philanthropist, creating the National Gallery, donating all his pictures to that, and putting by a very large amount of money, both to pay for the building and also to provide an endowment. Now, that is a unique range of achievement among Mellon's generation. He was preeminent in four fields in a way that cannot be said of any of the other names that I've already mentioned. What I want to talk about today mainly, though I will of course happily take questions on any other subject, is actually the first part of this, that's to say the business life, partly because it's most of what Mellon does until he's 65, partly because it is the business life that in a sense makes everything else possible. It's because he's so successful a businessman that he becomes Secretary of the Treasury, it's because he's so successful a businessman that he starts buying art, and it's because he's so rich a businessman that he can become a philanthropist. So business is the thing which underlies everything else. Now, as with many extremely successful men in business, Andrew Mellon was not self-made. This is not a rags-to-riches story. It's certainly a riches story, but it's really riches to even more riches, rather than, as it were, rags-to-riches. That's essentially how it happened. And in that sense, and many other ways too, the key to understanding Andrew Mellon is his very extraordinary father, Thomas Mellon. In some ways, the most astonishing figure in the whole of the Mellon family saga. He was born in 1813 in Northern Ireland, in Omagh, County Tyrone. The Mellons, his forebears, were Scots-Irish Presbyterians. They lived in Ulster. They were farmers. There was an extended family clan in Northern Ireland. They were Presbyterian in religion. They weren't Anglican. They certainly weren't Catholic. They thought of themselves as being middle-class agriculturalists. They didn't like the aristocracy who owned the land, and they certainly didn't like the Catholic Irish working class. And that gave to the Mellons, as to many Scots-Irish Presbyterians, I think, an embattled sense of determination, which Thomas Mellon certainly had, and which in his own generation, Andrew Mellon himself did as well. They didn't like Irish workers, they didn't like Irish Catholics, they didn't like landlords, and they didn't like taxation, and they didn't like interventionist government, of which taxation was the most eloquent and for them detested expression. You can see that we're in a world not wholly dissimilar from today, and there are, of course, many resonances, in fact, between this mindset and things that are going on or maybe not going on in the United States today. These are, in some senses, perennial issues. The Mellon family, including young Thomas, emigrate to America, searching for freedom, for land, for freedom from taxes, they hoped, for freedom from intrusive government in 1818. And they settled in western Pennsylvania as farmers. Thomas Mellon, Andrew's father, rejects that life. This is very important in the whole Mellon story. He rejects the notion that he is going to be a farmer as all Mellons have been before. He visits Pittsburgh in 1823 and he's very excited by the sight of a big town, which he hasn't really seen in America much before. In 1827, he read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. And Franklin's autobiography was, for Thomas Mellon, the canonical text, providing a broader justification for self-improvement, self-advancement, making the most of your talents. And Benjamin Franklin was always Thomas Mellon's hero. And over the front entrance of the second Mellon Bank building was a statue of Benjamin Franklin. In 1834, paying his own way, Thomas Mellon went to the University of Western Pennsylvania, subsequently the University of Pittsburgh, and qualified as a lawyer. He was also, in general, exceptionally well-read. He read lots of literature, lots of sociology, lots of philosophy, lots of science. He was a very, very remarkable figure. And in 1843, he married Sarah Jane Negley. And again, with his eye to business, she was an heiress. She owned a lot of land in Pittsburgh, which immediately, of course, went over to Thomas Mellon once they got themselves married. So Thomas was, or he has the makings of being, a self-made man, and part of the attributes of being self-made in his case is that he married well. Sarah Jane and Thomas produced 8 children. Only 4 survived to adulthood, and Andrew Mellon was the 6th of those children, and by a huge margin, the cleverest, the most creative, and the most historically significant. Pittsburgh was a very remarkable place to choose to settle, as Thomas Mellon did, in the middle decades of the 19th century. Located at the junction of 3 rivers, a major jumping-off point for the settlement of the West, prodigious reserves of bituminous coal, it soon develops in the second half of the 19th century into a major industrial area. And that's the base from which the Mellon fortune advances, as the Mellons become both the beneficiaries and the agents of further economic transformation. Thomas Mellon, as a lawyer, gets involved in lots of real estate. He buys lots of coal mines and he buys lots of iron. And those are the businesses that he moves into. He sees law as a way of getting into business. He doesn't see himself primarily as a professional figure in an established profession. He sees himself primarily as a businessman. And the businesses are all about doing things to land. Here's where the agricultural inheritance comes out. Building houses on land, developing real estate, mining coal, mining iron from underneath the land. And the way he operated as a businessman was that he put up the money and he got bright young entrepreneurs, as it were, to do the work. That was the kind of Mellon model for how to be successful in business. And it's that model which his son Andrew takes to far greater heights of sophistication, success, and profitability in his own generation. Thomas Mellon believed fanatically in hard work. The watchwords of his life were acquisition and accumulation. That's what he thought the purpose of life was about. He thought it was essential to live within your means. He thought it was utterly deplorable to get into debt. He was hostile to extravagance and what he called artificial wants. And I suspect he would have thought that Andrew Mellon's paintings came under the heading of artificial wants. He loathed ostentation. He was characterized by a stern sense of self-mastery and an iron will. He was not, in case it's not altogether yet clear, he was not a man to make a party go. Thomas Mellon may have rebelled against his parents, but he's determined his boys aren't going to rebel against him. And you may be surprised to know that with such a Napoleonic willpower, he ensured that they didn't rebel. The Mellon family, the house in Pittsburgh, was driven, rather humorless, very little fun or laughter. The air, I quote from another Mellon who's written on this, was heavy with the imperative to acquire and to succeed. That was the ethos of the place. And Thomas Mellon was determined that his sons would follow him and become businessmen. And he was determined that the way that would work would be on the basis of the model he's already perfected. He'll put up the money, he might even create an enterprise, and then he'll make it over to the sons and they'll get on with it. And the 2 eldest sons, James Ross and Thomas Alexander, he sets up in lumber, in real estate, and in a set of industries associated with that. But for the younger sons, and in particular, as it turns out, for Andrew, he has another idea. He decides to set up a bank. In 1869, and so there should be no mistaking his intentions or his name, it's called Thomas Mellon and Sons. It's a small-scale private bank in Pittsburgh, and it's intended to be for Andrew and for his younger brother, Dick Mellon, Richard Beatty Mellon. And it's that bank and the management of that bank by Andrew Mellon, who effectively takes it over when he's in his mid-20s. It's that bank, the management of that bank, and the extension of that bank, which is the key to everything else that happens in terms of the creation of the Mellon fortune. And it's very important to notice that this is essentially Andrew's enterprise. Dick is his collaborator, but Andrew is the cleverer one, though that's not easy to say to Dick's descendants in Pittsburgh, but nevertheless, it's true. But whenever Andrew was confronted with a major business decision, the first question he ever asked himself is, what would my father have done? So the dominance of Andrew's father throughout his life is enormously important. And in fact, what I've done in my book is that every chapter begins with an epigraph from Thomas Mellon's very extraordinary autobiography, which proved to be amazingly accurate predictions as to what, in fact, Andrew himself gets on with. Now, Andrew, like his father, is stern, driven, determined to acquire, aggressive in a rather understated way. He remains at home until he's 45. He doesn't marry until 1900, and his marriage is a catastrophe, but I can't tell you about that either today. You'll have to read how it all went wrong. Mellon's judgment of men and business was unerring. His judgment of women and love was catastrophic. You'll just have to settle for that for now, I'm afraid. There was little culture in his life. He didn't read books. He had no appreciation of music. Paul Mellon once told me he didn't think his father could tell the difference between Chopin and Cole Porter. He wasn't interested in plays or the theatre. He was a far less rounded figure, both personally and intellectually, than his father was. But he was brilliantly successful at business. And what Mellon sees more clearly, more imaginatively than anyone else, he had huge imagination when it came to business, though none at all when it came to human relations, is that Pittsburgh in the late 19th, early 20th century is going to become this most astonishing industrial town, which it does. It's the fastest growing town in America in the late 19th and early 20th century, built around steel and coal above all else, but lots of other industries too. And what Mellon does, and it's a simply brilliant idea, is that he converts this tiny private bank that his father's given him into a sort of venture capitalist enterprise, which is the agent and financier for the whole economic transformation of Western Pennsylvania. That's essentially what he does. It's a very simple idea, but he actually has the idea and carries it off. So between the late 1890s and the early 1900s, when Mellon is already quite old, I mean, he's not precociously rich early. He's in his mid-40s by now. Mellon executes a whole variety of astonishingly intricate financial manoeuvres, which makes him one of the richest men in America. First of all, he reinvents Thomas Mellon and Sons and converts it into the Mellon National Bank. And alongside that, he creates another organisation called the Union Trust. And it's those two banks together which provide Mellon with enormous financial flexibility and leverage, and through which, and through their enhanced resources, he finances lots of businesses. And those two enterprises are run by himself, by his brother, Richard Beatty Mellon, and by their very good friend, Henry Clay Frick, who has been a friend of Mellon's and indeed a client of the Mellon Bank since the 1880s. Now, one of the things that they do via those banks is invest in businesses that are already going in the Western Pennsylvania area. Natural gas, lots of that, coal and streetcars. And all those become major items in the Mellon investment portfolio. But the bit of Mellon that is really most extraordinary and really most creative was his capacity to spot new ideas put forward by new men which would result in wholly new businesses and, in certain cases, wholly new industries. And that's how he carries his father's sense of collaboration and of enabling to a wholly higher level. The businesses include that Mellon creates and finances: Standard Steel's Car, New York Shipbuilding, Crucible Steel, McClintic Marshall, but above all, Alcoa, Carborundum, and Gulf Oil. All of those were Mellon companies. And all of them began with a bright but poor figure showing up at the Mellon Bank and saying, "Hey, Mr. Mellon, I've got this idea about aluminum. Nobody else thinks it'll work." Mellon says, "I think it will work. Here's some money. Go on and do it." And that, it was as simple as that. And Mellon pulled off that trick of assessing, as it were, potential innovators and backing many of them, though not all of them, time after time after time. And, of course, as a result, he got shares in the companies, and as these companies prospered, which they invariably did, so he in turn prospered as well. And it was the sense of his judgment being very good over these schemes, which in the end becomes the thing for which he became most renowned. There is a story circulating in Pittsburgh, which I could never check out, that's to say there's no archival evidence for it, that Mellon's judgment wasn't absolutely infallible, that a bright young man comes along in the 1890s and says, "Mr. Mellon, I've got this idea, it's called automobiles. Will you finance me so I can make some automobiles?" And Mellon says no. And the man goes away and makes his automobiles somewhere else, and the somewhere else was Detroit, and the man was Henry Ford. Now, if it is the case that Mellon failed to spot Henry Ford, that's a big strike against him. But actually, there's no evidence that he did, so it may just be apocryphal. But by these means of growing and nurturing new companies above all else, Mellon became very rich and very successful. In 1902, he was worth about $20 million. By 1921, he was worth about $135 million. And by 1930, the peak of his fortune, he was worth about $160 or $70 million. And those are very conservative calculations. Like all rich men, Mellon didn't really know how rich he was. And it was very difficult, in fact, for him to calculate how rich he was, because most of his companies were private companies, not quoted on the stock exchange. Gulf Oil was owned by about five people. Many of the other companies were similar. And so it was very difficult to work out how much these shares were actually worth. But Mellon was not rich on a Rockefeller scale, and actually never was that rich. But by the standards of most people, he was pretty rich. Now, there are various things to say about the nature of this Mellon fortune. One of them, and this again is partly why he's a kind of absent figure in the history of this great phase of American economic growth, one of them is that it was largely invisible. As I've already suggested, none of the companies bore the Mellon name. They were all named after somebody else, or they were named on the basis of describing what the company did. But the only one that had the Mellon name was the bank, and that, of course, had been set up by their father. So many people simply didn't know that Gulf or Alcoa or Carborundum or Coppers or various other companies were Mellon companies. You couldn't guess from the name that they were, and the Mellons rarely revealed any public information about their companies, so it was very difficult to know. So it was a largely invisible, low-profile fortune. What is more, of course, unlike many of the other people I've mentioned, Rockefeller, Frick, Carnegie, Morgan, the Mellons were not associated with one single industry in the way that Rockefeller, say, was with oil, or Frick with coke, or Carnegie with steel, or Morgan with banking. The Mellons' portfolio is astonishingly varied and diverse. There's no one single industry, except maybe Alcoa, where you could say it's the Mellons and the Mellons are it. It's also interesting to notice, and again it's testimony, I think, to Mellon's brilliance, that the range of companies straddles both the old industrial enterprises of the 19th century, coal, iron, steel, to some extent railroads, and also the new industries of the 20th century, that's to say petrochemicals, Gulf, Alcoa and Carborundum. So Mellon's fortune and his investments are distributed right the way across old industries and new industries, and of course in the long run it's Gulf which becomes the greatest money spinner of them all. Now these industries operate, as I've already tried to suggest, on the basis of Mellon putting seed corn money in to get them started, supporting bright young men with brilliant ideas and then watching them grow. And for Mellon, that's what business was about. Business was not about idle, improper speculation on Wall Street, just trading in paper money. For Mellon, the serious business of business was what he called growing companies, making these, as they all become, multi-million-dollar enterprises thrive and flourish and become important. And interestingly, though again I can't talk about this today because there isn't time, that's exactly the same model that he applies in the end to the creation of the National Gallery in Washington. It's precisely the same business model that he uses for the gallery as he had already perfected in his business. Now this depended, of course, on extremely good judgment of men and of their projects, which on the whole, I think it is fair to say, Mellon genuinely had. And it also comes from this very strong sense, got from his father, of collaborators in business. So Charles Martin Hall and Arthur Vining Davis in the case of Alcoa, James Guffey in the case of Gulf Oil. There's a whole set of famous figures, Henry McEldowney in the case of the Union Trust. Mellon once said, real success means enabling other people to become successful. And that was Mellon's sense of himself, of his businesses, of why they were important, and of how he went about doing them. And that's, of course, essentially what the judge, his father, Thomas Mellon, had already said. Real success comes from helping to make other people successful. That was how Mellon saw his life and his work and his purpose. Well, Mellon's politics were a natural outgrowth in more ways than one of Mellon's business. And although, of course, it often used to be thought that a major motivating factor for many people in business was religion, religion isn't really a major motivating factor in Mellon's case. Mellon was not especially religious, and as somebody once said about him, in any case, he was so secretive, if Mellon ever had got religion, he wouldn't even have told it to God. So religion is not a big dynamic for Mellon in terms of his business. Mellon was a child of 19th century laissez-faire economics. That's the world he grew up in, that's the world he believed in, that's the world he helped to promote, that's the world he did well out of. So, like Frick and others of those contemporaries, he did not approve of government intervention, he did not like trust-busting, and he loathed organised labour. And there was, of course, this famous confrontation in Pittsburgh, or near Pittsburgh in 1892 at Homestead, between capital and labour, where Frick and Carnegie and Mellon are strongly on the side of capital, and the troops and the police are sent in, and the union was vanquished, and unionised labour doesn't reappear in western Pennsylvania until the early 1930s. Mellon believed in the free market, up to a point. He actually quite liked monopolies if he could get them. Alcoa certainly was a monopoly. He had pretty much a monopoly of Pittsburgh streetcars, and he certainly had a monopoly of western Pennsylvania coal. So actually, like many businessmen who paid lip service to unfettered, unbridled competition, actually they didn't mind monopoly if they could get it. And like many people who believed in a free market, he also actually believed in a tariff. He didn't mind the market being free inside America, but it didn't go any further than that. But Mellon did believe that this world, and on the whole minimalist government of unbridled capitalism, if I can put it that way, was the best of all possible worlds for everybody. He believed it was good for business, and he believed that what was good for business was good for America, and he believed that in creating large companies with more jobs, ordinary people would benefit as well, because they would have higher wages and incomes from working in industry than they would have done otherwise. So that was the basis of Mellon's sense of himself, not only as a great creative businessman, which I think he was, but as a great American patriot, that this was ultimately a patriotic enterprise. Mellon wasn't really interested in making money for its own sake. He never knew how rich he was. He didn't live a very ostentatious life. What excited him was the constructive enterprise of making enterprise constructive, if I can put it that way. Well, it may not surprise you to know that this meant he was a natural Republican. I think no prize is for guessing that that's where on the political divide Mellon would have come down. And it is, of course, rather interesting that most of Mellon's life, not all of it, but most of Mellon's life was lived not merely against a background of relatively laissez-faire government, which he thought was the best of all possible worlds, but, of course, from the Civil War through to the Great Depression, an era on the whole of Republican electoral hegemony in America. Not entirely, but predominantly. And that for Mellon was the best of all possible worlds, and he couldn't think that it would ever be different, and he thought that that was absolutely fine. The result of that is that Mellon does have a lot of involvement with the Republican Party machine in Pittsburgh, run by two people named Flynn and McGee, and a lot of the business to do with streetcars was to do with buying up franchises, and Mellon is certainly bankrolling the Republican Party there. The Pennsylvania state legislature was dominated by Republicans, and it was claimed that it was dominated by Republicans because it was owned by Mellon and Carnegie and Frick and the Pennsylvania Railroad. It was described by its critics as being the best legislature that money could buy. And it certainly is the case when it comes to Mellon's divorce that he gets the divorce law in Pennsylvania changed to his own satisfaction. But I can't tell you about that either. Mellon is also a major figure in Washington via the senators for Pennsylvania, who in a Republican era are enormously important figures, and it's they who essentially helped get Mellon the secretaryship of the Treasury in 1921 to 22. Now, what all this means, and this is a kind of dress rehearsal in a way, though nobody knew it at the time, is that Mellon was not happy with presidential politics from Theodore Roosevelt through to Woodrow Wilson. And when Roosevelt meet Mellon's, there's almost always trouble, as I'm sure I don't need to say here. Roosevelt had a kind of patrician disdain for parvenu wealth, which Franklin Roosevelt would have later on. He was, of course, ostensibly a Republican, but he was pretty much on the left of the Republican Party. Henry Clay Frick observed memorably on one occasion about Roosevelt, "We bought that son of a bitch, but he didn't stay bought," which tells you quite a lot about what they thought they were doing. Mellon did not like Taft, who initiates lots of antitrust suits during his period as president, and he certainly didn't like Woodrow Wilson. It's under Wilson that Alcoa is first federally prosecuted for being a monopoly. It's under Wilson, of course, that the federal income tax is instituted. It's under Wilson that the Federal Reserve Board, an early attempt to regulate banking. Mellon didn't think banking should be regulated. And it was under Wilson, of course, that there was the attempt to get America into the League of Nations. And Mellon bankrolls a group of Republicans who put a stop to that. Now, what is interesting is that in the progressive era, Mellon is not happy with the way politics here in Washington are going. And many of those issues that come up about business, about the power of business, about banking, about income tax, about the role of business in American life, all, of course, come up again in a much more febrile and frenzied way and much more antagonistic way for Mellon himself when FDR is in power from 1932 on. But I'm not going to talk about that either. You can see I'm actually talking about all the things I'm not talking about, if you see what I mean. In any event, and this is really the final thing I do want to talk about now, Mellon is a major financier for the Republican Party. And in 1920, he is a very, very significant financier for the Republican Party because, like many others, he senses the Republicans are going to win, that the Wilsonian era is discredited. It's time for a serious change. And Harding, of course, wins the nomination and the election, and he is lobbied very hard by the two Pennsylvania Republican senators, Boies Penrose and Philander Knox, that Andrew Mellon should be the Secretary of the Treasury. Harding has no idea who Mellon is. Most people have no idea who Mellon is. Penrose and Knox make the case that what you want at the Treasury is not some airy-fairy academic. What you want is somebody who has a practical understanding of how the economy works. And Mellon, for obvious reasons, scores very high under that issue. If you're going to have, moreover, a government whose ethos is going to be sympathetic to business, the best way to send that signal out is to put a businessman at the Treasury. So Mellon becomes Secretary of the Treasury in the aftermath of Harding's victory and takes up office in March 1921. And he's Secretary of the Treasury under Harding, under Coolidge, and for a very large part of Herbert Hoover's presidency as well, hence the observation that three presidents served under him. For much of that time, he is acclaimed as the greatest Secretary of the Treasury since Alexander Hamilton. Mellon didn't like Harding much. He once said he'd never have given Harding an even halfway middle management job in any of his companies. He and Hoover got on, but only up to a point. The really close relationship, in fact, was with Calvin Coolidge. And Mellon and Coolidge got on extremely well. Both of them, of course, were legendarily taciturn figures, neither of them men of many words. You, I don't need me, I'm sure, to remind you that a woman once went up to Coolidge and said, "Mr. President, I've been bet that I can get you to say three words." And he turned to her and said, "You lose," and walked away. Well, it was said that Mellon and Coolidge conversed in pauses and silences rather than in words. The first and longer phase of Mellon's time as Secretary of the Treasury was a terrific success, and he was a very remarkable Secretary of the Treasury. That's from 1921 to 1929. This is when he's there to deliver on the agenda that the business of America is business, Calvin Coolidge's famous formulation. What Mellon has got to try to do is to sort both the domestic mess and the international mess that's been left in the aftermath of the First World War, to get government spending down, to get the debt down, and to reorganize the international financial world on the basis of tradable currencies and the restoration of the gold standard that crashed into ruin during the First World War. And roughly speaking, Mellon manages all of that. He does reduce taxes, not only for the rich, but for the poor as well. Very few people are actually paying federal taxes by 1929. And Mellon did believe that rich people ought to pay taxes. And he believed that by reducing taxes, they were more likely to pay than by keeping them at a high level. And of course, Mellon understood the attitude of rich people towards taxes. He did reduce the debt, the national debt, by about a third. And he thought that you should treat the federal finances like a personal account or like a bank account. Balance the budget, get the debt down. And he also plays a major part in reorganizing international finance as the gold standard is restored, and as during the 1920s up until 1929, it really does look as though everything is getting better. Mellon, in a sense, does invent the idea of trickle-down economics. That's to say that if you can make an economy prosperous, if the rich get richer, actually everybody else will get richer sooner or later, and during the course of the Roaring Twenties, many of them did. And as I say, Mellon is enormously important in restoring international financial stability as well. So it's not surprising that Mellon was, in fact, the most celebrated member of these Republican administrations through until 1929, and was seen as somebody who had been astonishingly successful. And here we have, in a sense, the banker as hero, the man who has had a brilliant career in business, now applying these business talents to the restoration and recovery of the nation and of the international economy, and doing so with astonishing skill, justifying, as it seemed, the belief that the best people to run any federal government ought to be business people, because the business of America was business. Mellon's great mistake was that he didn't quit in 1928, when Coolidge very shrewdly did quit. And Mellon's reputation goes down from 1929 on, with, of course, the great crash on Wall Street of October 1929. Mellon didn't care about the great crash on Wall Street. He despised speculators, and he thought they deserved all the trouble they got. And he was wholly indifferent to it, but that was not politically a very sensible position to adopt. Moreover, of course, the slump of the autumn of 29 is just the beginning of an unprecedented, almost cataclysmic, international economic meltdown, which goes through until 1933, in the sense that things keep getting worse. Trade collapses, currencies collapse, employment skyrockets, banks go broke across the length and breadth of the country. Business collapses, many people's savings are wiped out, millions were unemployed, unemployment rates in towns like Pittsburgh were well over 50%. Mellon's view is the one that you would expect of a figure of his era. This is what happens. Booms come and go, slumps come and go, we've just got to get on with it and do the best we can. That was all right if you were Andrew Mellon, but it was not all right if you were ordinary Americans, millions of them, who'd been ruined. And Mellon never quite understood, I think, that the government couldn't just say, it's all very shocking, but just bear with us and it'll get better. Nor could he afford to say that in a world in the early 1930s, when fascism and communism were on the march and when there were genuine fears that, in fact, capitalism would not survive at all. Mellon's reputation, therefore, collapses along with the American and the international economy. And from having been the hero, perhaps overpraised, in the 1920s, he now becomes the villain. And I remember Paul Mellon telling me that on one occasion in the early 30s, he'd been driving from Pittsburgh to Washington to see his father. And he'd stopped at a garage and gone to a men's room. And over the urinal, he'd seen painted, daubed, the following words. Hoover blew the whistle, Mellon rang the bell, Wall Street gave the signal, and the country went to hell. Mellon's political position collapses. He's threatened with impeachment in January 1932, for reasons, again, I'm afraid I can't go into now, but there was a very strong case made by a guy called Wright Patman that Mellon should be impeached. As a result, he resigns as Secretary of the Treasury and goes to London as American ambassador to Britain from March 1932 to March 1933. He loved it. He had a great time. He took all his pictures there. He secured an amazing new business deal for Gulf Oil, but not much else happened. FDR, of course, wins the November 32 election and takes over as president in March 1933. Riding, in a sense, this disillusioned wave of hostility to the Republican administrations of which Mellon himself was so conspicuous, an ornament up to a point and a liability thereafter. How it was that FDR created a political mood which was totally different from the presuppositions Mellon had accepted, why it was that Mellon was prosecuted for tax evasion, and what the connection is between all of that and the National Gallery, I'm sorry to say that, along with everything else, I just don't have time to tell you. Thank you. But if it's all right, Chris, I will answer questions.
Can you tell me what he did? I've heard that the slump we had in 1920, 1921 was actually in some ways worse than the Great Depression, and yet it didn't have the effect of the Great Depression. Yeah. And at least Jim Powell, in his new book about it, in his book about FDR, says that FDR and Hoover both made the Great Depression worse.
Well, I suppose that the main point I'd want to make is that one of the things that I think was not clear at the time, or maybe it was to Mellon but not to many other people, is that Mellon didn't actually have much power as Secretary of the Treasury, because no Secretary of the Treasury had much power. I mean, very few people were paying income tax, federal income tax. The Federal Reserve manipulating the interest rates wasn't enough to do anything. The banking system was unregulated, which may or may not have been a good thing, but it meant Mellon couldn't do anything about it. So that on the whole, as it were, the United States approached the slump of 29 to 31 without what might have been thought the necessary means to do much about it. I mean, whether it should have done or shouldn't is a different issue. It's certainly the case that in the short run, from 1919 to 21, things were very bad. They were not, and it depends how you do the comparisons. But I think the comparisons that still make 29 to 33 worse are the enduring rate of unemployment and the collapse of banks. And those figures are certainly worse in the later of those two depressions. How far, I mean, there is an argument to be made, and in a sense it's made in this book, that Mellon and all his friends were actually right. I mean, after all, unemployment was still running at, what, 20% in 1940 in this country? I mean, there is an argument that although FDR talks a lot and invents lots of agencies, it doesn't actually do very much. That in the end, the economy does indeed have to recover of its own volition, or, of course, more importantly, I suppose, as a result of the Second World War, which, of course, America isn't in 1940, but the order books are already beginning to expand. And I think there is some truth in that. I mean, the latest scholarship on FDR does argue that he didn't do as much to halt the Depression as his earlier admirers like Arthur Schlesinger did. And I think there is a lot of truth in that. But I think that all of that does miss the point, though again it's not provable, that what FDR offered in a way that it didn't seem as though Hoover had done, and in a way that Mellon certainly didn't, he kind of offered hope. And while that might not affect the performance of business, I don't think there's any doubt that it affected the mindset of the American people in a constructive way. I mean, one of the ironies about Mellon and Roosevelt having different views of the economy and, of course, different views of Andrew Mellon's tax returns, something else I didn't have time to talk about, is that they disagreed on ends but not they disagreed on means but not ends. I mean, both of them wanted to save the capitalist system. Mellon's view was it'll save itself. FDR's view was that's not good enough. We've got to try to give it a helping hand. But the disagreement, in fact, was about means, not ends.
Thank you, sir. You alluded to Mellon's alleged reticence about his Presbyterian religion. I wondered if you ran during your research to the structure that was called Mellon's Fire Escape to Heaven.
Yes, indeed I did. I should explain that the East Liberty Presbyterian Church was where the Mellons had worshipped, as it were, from Thomas Mellon's time on, from the time they'd settled in Pittsburgh. And in the late 1920s, early 1930s, a new huge Presbyterian church was built on the East Liberty site of cathedral-like proportions, designed by that man Cram, who did the campus at Yale. And it was known as Mellon's Fire Escape. It was thought this was their way of hedging their bets to get to heaven. But what is interesting about this is that it was the only thing on which Andrew Mellon and his brother Dick did not collaborate. All the money for that came from Dick. Mellon disapproved of it, and the only time Mellon entered that church was in his casket for his funeral.
Also, I wanted to mention that inside the church there was a bowling alley and a gymnasium, and they were going to put a swimming pool in originally, but across the street was the YMCA, so decided not to do that. So it became a center.
Yep.
Or everything.
But Mellon disapproved of it very strongly. He thought it was a terrible waste of money on his brother's part.
Martin Hutchinson, I write a column called The Bear's Lair. Isn't the interesting comparison on the Great Depression with Britain, the United Kingdom, where you also had a businessman, Secretary of the Treasury, of course, which was Neville Chamberlain, though nowhere near as successful a businessman, and where he, in fact, used orthodox methods, although bringing in a modest tariff, but also cutting civil service salaries by 10% on the grounds that prices had dropped and therefore the civil servants could earn less. And if you look at the numbers, he got out of the Great Depression a great deal quicker. Britain was doing fine by about 34.
Yes, though, of course, there is partly the argument that Britain hadn't done as well in the 20s as America had done, so there was an element of catching up. It's certainly true, back to, I think, the point that was raised over here, that Mellon's, the last revenue bill, I mean, it's not passed until he's gone to Britain, but the last revenue bill that Mellon sees through as Secretary of the Treasury does raise taxes very considerably. And, in fact, it provides FDR with his tax base, ironically. The greatest increase in taxes in terms of bringing more people in to pay because the majority of people in America did not pay federal government taxes in the late 1920s. Mellon extends the number of people very considerably who pay taxes. And, of course, as you say, that's taking money out of the system, which is probably not a good idea. But it's certainly the case that these Anglo-American comparisons are both revealing but tricky, because you have to compare the very different economic trajectories in the 20s as well as the different remedies that they resort to, as well as in explaining the different trajectories in the 30s.
The sale of paintings from the Hermitage by the Stalin's government was not a secret for a long time in U.S. It took about 60 years for the Soviet government to acknowledge the fact. And since Gorbachev times, the archives were opened. Mm. I wonder if you researched those archives and if you uncovered any new facts.
This was a question about Mellon's purchase of the Hermitage pictures. It's one of the most amazing episodes in his career. If I could just say that Mellon decides in about 1927 to 1928 that he's going to fund and found and finance a National Gallery. And that's very important because it's ages before the tax trial. Mellon is determined to create a great gallery in Washington, model on the National Gallery in London. And the art dealer Duveen is very important in persuading Mellon to do that. And if you look at Mellon's pattern of buying pictures, it goes into a much higher gear from 27, 28 on. He's no longer buying pictures for his own walls, he's buying pictures for a national collection. I mean, even Mellon didn't need two Raphael Madonnas on his mantelpiece, as it were. And of course, the great piece of good fortune for him is the Hermitage sales. Here is Mellon already determined to, as it were, jumpstart a great gallery of his own. And here, entirely flukishly, 2 years later, a job lot of great pictures from one of the greatest galleries of the world becomes available. And it's the most astonishing coincidence. And it's an amazing story, which again, you'll not be surprised to know, I don't have time to go into. But a syndicate is put together of Knoedlers in New York, of the Matthiessen, of Kolnagis in London, and of the Matthiessen Gallery in Berlin. And all the correspondence is there. And I did indeed, to get to your question, I don't read Russian, but the Andrew Mellon Foundation funded this enterprise, so it was done on an agreeable scale, shall I say. And I took an entourage to Russia, and we did see the papers in Moscow, and above all, we did see the papers in the Hermitage. Piotrowski let us look. And I don't read Russian, but I was assured by my colleagues who did that the telegrams really were from Moscow, and they would say, next Monday morning, a man is going to arrive in a trench coat with a big packing case. You take the Van Eyck Annunciation off the walls, you give it him, you then rearrange the pictures so it doesn't look as though anything's gone. He will then get on the train to Berlin, and then it will end up in Washington. And that's what happened. That's what happened. Of course, there are many ironies, of course, of this deal. Here's Mellon, the supreme capitalist, doing business with the communists, who are the supreme enemy. Here is Mellon, Secretary of State, in a government which doesn't even recognize communist Russia. So that's all pretty strange. But it was the most remarkable deal. He bought 21 pictures for $7 million. And, of course, like the communists, he wants to keep it quiet. They don't want to admit it's happened. And as you say, it's 60 years before, under Piotrowski and Gorbachev, it begins to come out. And they have been very good at publishing the documents. But he also doesn't want anyone here to know, because he's afraid if people know he's got this gallery scheme and he's buying these pictures, the prices will all be driven up. And for Mellon, an enormous part of the pleasure of buying pictures was getting them for less than the dealers wanted. And it's the pleasure of the chase of getting the pictures, which is part of what turns Mellon on. And both Duveen and Knoedlers always try to sell for higher prices than Mellon wants. Mellon has this amazing deal that any picture they think he ought to buy, he hangs in his Washington apartment for 2 years, and if he doesn't like it, he can send it back. And these are dealers who are often very strapped for cash, and Mellon plays with them and plays them off against each other, and on occasions even lends them money. And they're very well matched. Mellon once had this wonderful phrase: no picture ever looked so good as when Duveen was standing in front of it. Duveen was the most amazing salesman, and his letters to Mellon, I mean, they are hyperbole on a kind of Himalayan scale. I mean, every picture is the most wonderful, the most brilliant. Mr. Mellon, you must have this. Your collection will not be complete without it. And it's amazing correspondence. Duveen also had Mellon's butler in his pay. And so the butler would tell Duveen when Mellon was in a good mood, and then Duveen would just show up and say, oh, Mr. Mellon, I was just passing and I got this Rembrandt. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. Next.
Question about his personality that touches on this topic you were just discussing. I don't know if you're familiar with a novel called The Forsyte Saga.
I am.
It seems to me the commercial side of that family could have been based on Mellon, and your depiction of his father and the culture of that family was the best part of this wonderful talk. That was so well done. And I am curious to go a little more into the art side of this enormously commercial man. Mm. When he was buying the pictures, was it some sort of souped-up commercial venture, make money on art, or did he have a true art sensibility? And if so, where did it come from? Was it repressed somehow from his father? And if you have time, I'd also like to know, at the end of his life, did he feel he had been a success, or was he in any way tarred by the sense of tax evasion or whatever, these other things you don't have time to talk about?
Well, you obviously want me to give another lecture, and that's a very kind invitation, but we all have other things to do. The Soames Forsyte thing is very interesting. Paul Mellon, in his autobiography, Reflections in a Silver Spoon, describes his father as being like Soames Forsyte. And I have to say, it's another thing I didn't have time to go into, the private lives of the Mellons. It's a sort of gothic horror show. It's not wholly a typical gothic horror show. That's to say, the great man, the founder of the family's riches, i.e. Andrew, thinks the son is a disappointment. And this is, you know, Rothschild, Getty, you can produce any number of examples of this. Andrew wants Paul to go into the bank at Pittsburgh. Paul loves Cambridge, horses, England, blah, blah. He doesn't want to go to Pittsburgh. He can't see any point in making any more money. But Andrew makes plain to Paul that Paul is a disappointment to him. I think Paul was a very admirable man, I ought to say. And I think if you read Paul's autobiography with very close textual attention, you can see what a struggle he had to make a life for himself, bearing, as he did, the twin burdens of very strong parental disapproval and a huge amount of money. And in the end, I think Paul made a very admirable life for himself. But I think it was quite a struggle to get there, and it took huge amounts of analysis, both Jungian and Freudian, to do so. That's merely a specific instance of a general phenomenon in many rich families of these intergenerational problems. As far as was Andrew turned on by art, well, he starts buying art in the 1900s to decorate the house in Pittsburgh that he finally acquires when he gets married. Now, it actually is the case that lots of the rich of Pittsburgh bought pictures. Nodlers have a branch in Pittsburgh in the 1890s and 1900s. The only person at that point in Pittsburgh who is buying inspired pictures is Frick. And the Frick-Mellon friendship is very interesting. They each introduce the other's wives to them. I mean, there's a very complicated set of interconnections there. But Mellon's early purchases through until till his marriage collapses in 1910 are almost exactly what everybody else in Pittsburgh is buying. They're genre paintings, Barbizon School, very occasional English 18th century portrait, but not much else. The purchasing stops when the marriage collapses. When he goes to Washington, he has this very posh apartment, the purchasing starts again. And from 1921 to 27, he's buying for his own house, and it's mainly Northern European landscapes and 18th century English portraits. And he says, these are my English beauties on the walls. These women, unlike his wife, who he owns, who are in frames, who can't answer back, and that's Andrew's notion of a human relationship after his catastrophic marriage. So I think he buys pictures for different reasons. I think, you know, it's for domesticity, it's for solace, it's then for the gallery. And I think he's buying pictures with these purposes in mind. Whether he was ever moved by art, I don't know. He once claimed that if you looked at the whole of a picture, it gave you some sort of pleasure, but he was never any good at writing that down. And as I said earlier, and I will elaborate a bit on this, the creation of the gallery is the final great deal as an enabler. I mean, it's the Alcoa Carborundum Gulf Oil model. He says, here's my money for a building and an endowment. Here are my pictures. This is the beginning of a great enterprise that others will develop. And that's why he doesn't call it the Mellon Gallery, because he spotted with Frick and Huntington that if you name a collection after the founding figure, nobody else will give. And, of course, what makes the National Gallery so astonishing is that all these, Widener, Chesterdale, most of the Mellon's friends, all give their collections. And that's how it works. So it's his final great coup as an enabler, really. Now, absolutely the last thing, the tax trial, and did he feel his life had been in vain? It's absolutely clear that the tax trial was a politically motivated persecution of Mellon. The argument was Mellon had broken lots of laws in the 1920s. As Secretary of the Treasury, he was not supposed to be involved in business, and as Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, he was not supposed to own bank shares. When he becomes Secretary of the Treasury, he conveys his bank shares to his brother and still gets the income from them, and he's still much involved in business. And I have chapter and verse on that. And Mellon lies about that. He actually says, I have withdrawn from business as though I had died. And in the tax trial, somebody says, well, if that's your notion of death, it sounds a rather interesting idea. Mellon lies about that. So when the Democrats get in, they want to go for Mellon, and they use the vehicle of tax evasion, which, of course, the Republicans had used, for instance, with Al Capone. I mean, Al Capone is got for tax evasion, not because that's the thing they wanted him for, but it was what they could get him for. And there are a set of high-profile tax trials under Roosevelt, most famously Moses Annenberg, Thomas Lamont, and Mellon. Now, the problem is that the one rule Mellon didn't break in the 20s was that he paid his taxes. And there is chapter and verse on that. Mellon did believe that rich men should pay taxes. And so in the end, they go for him for the wrong issue. And to his friends, it was always a terrible tragedy that, of course, the exoneration only comes after his death. It goes on from 1934 to 1937. He is, in the end, exonerated. But the further irony is that it's the gallery that gives the justification for the tax trial. Mellon sets up the Andrew Mellon Educational and Charitable Trust in December 1930, into which, over the next years, he funnels the pictures and he funnels a lot of his money, with the view that it will form the gallery. And he takes deductions against his income for those donations. And the Treasury, and above all the Department of Justice, say those are fake deductions. He's not going to produce a gallery. It's a dishonest fraud. It's a deliberate system to defraud the United States government. And all that was just untrue.
David, may we ask you to take one more question?
Yes. Would you like to suggest which one it should be?
No. How hard was it for the bright young men with ideas to get in to see Mr. Mellon?
How hard was it for the bright young men with their ideas to get in to see Mr. Mellon? What kind of a screening system did he have? Obviously, it couldn't be just anybody.
Yes, I think that that whole side of Mellon is one where one would love to know more. I mean, one of Mellon's problems is that almost nothing is ever written down. Because, of course, what Mellon is really doing, I mean, to put this in rather fancy jargon, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century is a major era of Schumpeterian innovation. And what Mellon is doing is the reality check on potential Schumpeterian innovators in western Pennsylvania in the late 19th and early 20th century. And he does it rather well. I think this sort of took on a life of its own, that after one or two of these, and the first great successes are Alcoa and Carborundum, Mellon does kind of get a reputation for this, and people do show up. And Mellon was very good in business meetings. That's when he wasn't taciturn. That's when he asks extremely shrewd questions. But I take your point. Who were the gatekeepers? And Mellon did have, I mean, one of the other aspects of the Mellon system I didn't have time to go into is there is an entourage of, as it were, subordinates who helped Mellon all the way through his life. And I think it must in part have been to do with them. And, of course, what we don't know is how many schemes Mellon turned down. I mean, he did have this reputation for amazing judgment, which clearly is up to a point merited. But, you know, if he did turn Henry Ford down, that's quite a strike against him. And, of course, you know, we only know the success stories. I mean, it may be that there weren't any failures, but by definition, you know, the only stories we know are the ones that blossom and develop.
Ladies and gentlemen, bear with me for one second, please. I would like to thank David for a really gripping and exquisite lecture. I would like to note the fact that he very cleverly held back some of the juiciest parts of his book. This was a marketing ploy because the book itself is on sale in the next room. And I hope that you will join me in a reception in honor of our lecturer and stop by the bookstall in the course of the reception. David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
For more information about Andrew Mellon, visit the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation at www.mellon.org.